demonstrated is useful, including generating a project model trade space, doing risk analysis, and other things. Okay, so we'll look for that tonight. Any other announcements? I don't think so. I'm excited to see you guys before they come up. My last round of lectures. So we're here with RAP today. This is Mike Trice and Nora Jackson. And we've been working with this team for a number of years. Some of you, did any of you take Mike's class in over IEP on technical communications? I think some of you may have. Thanks, Dyke. I noticed that, you know, our work together improved. I'm going to hand the ball to them. But it's not just this framing lecture in the first hour, but I'm going to encourage every team to leverage their support. They're here to coach and to work with you between now and the main presentation. Finally, I saw a note this morning on the main presentations, the slides that went out on Monday do show the schedule in more detail. There'll be an update to the overall schedule released this week. And go back to the team's guide. The team's guide released in January actually details what we expect and the rubric for what we're doing in May. With that, Mike, the floor is yours.
All right. Hi, everybody. My name is Michael. My doctorate is in rhetoric and professional communications. We have multiple doctorates in rhetoric, which I'm very excited about. I was not expecting the spread in this class that there would be. Dyke, thank you very much for owning the fact that you had seen me before. I see other faces in the crowd as well who I've worked with off and on. So it's good to be able to see those of you that I recognize. We're going to talk a little bit about presentations. And really what Nora and I are here to do is to let you know a little bit about some of the advisory services that we can provide to you as you move forward with preparing those final presentations. So let's open this up with a question. Who's familiar with the curse of knowledge? What's the curse of knowledge?
Once you know something, it's harder for you to see the flaws in it, and it's harder for you to communicate those things because you already see the details, but the untrained eye can't see them.
Yeah, so the more you know about something, the harder it is for you to explain it to someone else. And you all have some adaptations that you've made in the process of your careers in order to be able to accommodate for the curse of knowledge. You take certain stances in order to be able to explain things to a new audience. We're going to think about thinking about that a little bit more critically. One of the things I'd like to do is, who's familiar with, does anyone know or recognize the name Elizabeth Newton? Stanford undergrad? So Elizabeth Newton did one of the first true quantifications of the curse of knowledge that we know about. So what Newton did was she had a test case in the control group, and she asked them in order to be able to tap out basic songs, like lyrics, nursery rhymes, things like that, just by tapping, and then to see if the listeners could understand what was being tapped out. So, the people doing the tapping, just tapping out their songs, what percentage of their listeners do you think they thought understood the song that the thing tapped to them? Higher than 10, lower than 70? 50. So the tappers thought 50% of their audience knew what was being tapped out. What percentage of tappers do you think actually guessed the correct song? Lower. Higher than zero. Two's close. 2.5. 2.5% of tappers guessed the correct song. So, while we know the curse of knowledge, when we know our audience doesn't know what's in our head, we still tend to drastically overestimate how much the audience knows versus what we're trying to tell them. So we've really got to think of ways in order to make what we're saying understandable, appealing, interesting, viable to the audience in a number of different mechanisms. So, let's talk a little bit about quantification. Let's talk a little bit about history. So here are some recent headlines. We're not so recent anymore. Carbon tax rhetoric versus reality. Trans people face rhetoric disinformation after shooting. Don't overheat holiday with inciting rhetoric. Arrowhead groups warns political readers. So rhetoric has a little bit of a negative connotation in popular usage. What do you think of when you think of rhetoric?
Politics.
That's a common one. Yep, absolutely.
Strongly worded, aggressive commentary.
Okay, strongly punditry. Punditry is the word that you're looking for there. But yes, strongly worded, aggressive. Absolutely, yes. Other thoughts? Yes.
Persuasive.
Okay. So that's gentler. That's nice. I mean, we all want to be persuasive on some level. Does anyone have thoughts of what they mean when they think of persuasive? What does persuasion mean? Yeah.
Influence.
Yeah. Influence is persuasion is a core way of gaining influence. Yeah.
Logical.
Logical, yeah. Okay, yep. Logic is one of the core areas we want to emphasize in persuasion, particularly in rhetoric. Yes?
The ability to get someone else to see things through your point of view.
Okay, yeah. So that's one of the ways in which, you know, we would like to think of an ethical use of persuasion. Be able to have someone see things through your point of view, to be able to transfer as much as possible your perception of things to someone else. Whether or not you end up convincing them or not, to be able to give them insight into the knowledge that you have. One way to think of rhetoric as opposed to philosophy directly is to think of rhetoric as a mechanism for sharing knowledge. Rhetoric, admittedly, is not all that interested in finding truth. That's much more the realm of philosophy. But what responsible rhetoric is interested in doing is how do we share the knowledge that we know. Whether what we know is truth or belief or emotion, how is it that we share what we know with someone else so that sharing is understandable? It's more about the spread of knowledge necessarily than the direct pursuit of truth or the creation of knowledge other than how do we share and how do we create knowledge communally by sharing what we know. So, some history on rhetoric is, this is a very basic definition, the ability in each case to see all of the available means of persuasion. And then the responsibility to choose the effective and the ethical means of persuasion within those available means. You want to speak Greek? You want to speak ancient Attic? It's been 20 years for me, so I'm tempted to try the pronunciation, but my pronunciation is going to be pretty rusty. So, this is theory. And really, what I want to do today is to kind of move from this unknown theoresi, a old sort of blanket piece of knowledge that, you know, is kind of inaccessible, to something a little bit more familiar with the theory. And hopefully in the process make your persuasions a little bit more dynamic and interesting. More so, build upon the skills that you already have, understanding that many of you have lots of experience in this area. All right. So we want to take a look at some useful means of persuasion and how you can sort of see, how you can wrestle with this curse of knowledge in order to make your arguments and transfer the knowledge that you have, the ideas that you have, to the people that you want to be able to pitch these solutions to. How do you make them understand the problem as you see it? How do you make them understand all of the solutions that you are discussing and why you have selected the solutions that you're going to settle upon? All right, so here's a little bit of history on rhetoric. So from the Western standpoint, rhetoric begins kind of in Greece, in Syracuse, just off the tip here, How many people think that, how many people remember being taught about writers who are starting in Athens with the ancient Greeks? They've heard Plato, Aristotle. Okay. They actually didn't start things. What happens, though, is they get really famous, and, you know, Aristotle lucks into being the tutor of this particularly well-known guy called Alexander the Great, so all of his books get preserved. So all the people that Aristotle synthesizes get lost to time, but guess whose books we end up with? We end up with Aristotle and the people that he, and the Romans that he ended up influencing. We lose a lot of books otherwise, but a lot of this sort of begins down in Syracuse. The power vacuum, and they decide that they want to go about doing things in a different way. So, they reject the idea that human destiny is shaped by the gods. They want to try something a little bit more rational, dare we say, not quite yet, but a little bit more democratic, perhaps. And in order to do this, the teaching of rhetoric emerges. Because there's a tradition that begins to occur here where the more the citizenry teach, not all of the citizenry, but the more of the citizenry you teach in order to be able to have these types of conversations, then the better they're going to be generally in decision making. There's a lot of citizenry that still gets excluded at this point, of course. All right, so a few years pass, and the teaching of principles of public address begins to emerge. So what are the skills necessary in order to make a persuasive argument? So when someone said that when they think of rhetoric and they think of persuasion, they think of politicians and pundits, that goes back to the very beginning. That's really where it started, is to influence political discussion, to influence civil discussion of what's occurring. So politics and the law, back in 200, 300 BC is where rhetoric begins, and it continues primarily as a legal and political tradition all the way through to the modern day, with some variances and some buildings that we'll go ahead and we'll get into. All right, now things get a little bit bigger in Athens as they begin to teach techne as an art, and some divides sort of begin to develop. Socrates believes to sees rhetoric as a form of persuasion, but he gets really into this other art form. Any guesses as to what that art form is? Philosophy. That is right. Socrates and his primary student, who is Plato, that's right. They develop this grand art called philosophy, which is much more interested in the pursuit of truth than the pursuit of persuasion. And this leads to some interesting outcomes. Plato becomes a lot more authoritarian and autocratic in his belief of how things should be done because, you know, truth is a lot harder to see than just persuading people in order to be able to do things. So Plato believes in truth, and there's a bit of a backlash from him in his writings and an ongoing discussion that continues to this day between Plato and Aristotle about the balance between the pursuit of truth in philosophy and what we can actually share and persuade one another to do within the field of rhetoric. So, once again, this guy comes about really popular. Once again, I want to remind everyone that he's really popular because he's synthesizing a lot of authors that got lost to history. But Aristotle does think in terms of an audience. He acknowledges that the audience has certain predispositions, and he wants to consider the limits or affordances of the situation that we're in. There's something called the kairotic moment. Has anyone heard kairos, the term kairos before? So kairos is the opportune moment to make a particular argument. It means when you are considering the context that you're in, the timing that you're in, your argument captures what the audience needs at that moment and that time. And what is the best form of persuasion for talking to someone in that moment? And this should feel very familiar to everyone because really at its heart is a lot of what drives modern industry and modern science, and that is, what's our motivating problem? Why do I care about this now? Why does the field need to move forward with this particular problem at this particular time? And it's one of those crucial questions that you have to ask yourself in order to be able to, A, convince yourself that you have that answer, and then B, be able to give that insight to your audience, knowing all of the gaps that lay between you and them. And then be aware of choice and recognize that influence is ideally non-coercive. You want to recognize that power gap. At the end of the day, who's going to make the decision? Are you going to make the decision? Who decides if your proposals go forward? I mean, you've got a little bit of sway in doing the research, putting the information forward, but you're handing it over to other decision makers. All right, so one of the reasons that rhetoric survives is the Romans were really into the Greeks. So since Rome manages to conquer a huge amount of Europe, rhetoric gets enshrined as a teaching mechanism, and once Rome decides to disruptively decentralize, we'll call it, the Catholic Church steps in and begins the process of continuing the rhetorical tradition. But Cicero, back before the rise of the empire, introduces Greek philosophy to the Romans. And he portrays it more as a skill, and he's really interested in a core question that we're wrestling with today. And that is, you know, given the power of persuasion, particularly among the powerful, what makes someone a worthy speaker? What makes you trustworthy as a speaker? What is the responsible use of this persuasive power? And who's heard of the terms ethos, logos, and pathos? Really popular sort of high school education of rhetoric now in the States. So we're going to talk a little bit about that, but in a much deeper way. But this does get to why ethos is a core crux of what makes rhetoric is Cicero's interest in you have to be, this in order to be worthy of being a speaker, worthy of attention, you have to have a certain amount of ethical interest and ethical restraint in what you're doing. That only the good and the worthy are, you know, warrant, you know, that power. Which is a little ironic given what happens to Cicero. Anybody know what happens to Cicero? So, Cicero, what's that? Anybody up top? Anyone want to share history?
This is Brian.
Yeah.
I'll try this microphone. I think he stopped thinking and disappeared.
He stopped thinking and disappeared. Yeah. He was disappeared, and he definitely stopped thinking after being disappeared. After Caesar's failed attempt to rise to emperor, we just got done with the Ides of March, historical day for assassins everywhere, where Cicero was killed by the Senate. Well, shortly thereafter, some of Caesar's adopted progeny and others made short work of Cicero. So he succumbed to the revolution that would bring about the Roman Empire, kind of ironically enough. And it defines some fundamental canons of the art of rhetoric. All right, so what are these five canons? We'll do some engagement around assassination in order to lead you back to some things you've probably heard about before. So they are invention, arrangement, style, memory, and delivery. Who has heard these before? A handful of us have heard of these before. Okay. So these are sort of literally the classical ways that presentations used to be taught. So invention is how we find arguments. We're going to talk a lot about invention. Arrangement, just put them in a logical order. So, and a lot of times now, arrangement is sort of thought of in genre terms. So what is the order that your audience expects the type of presentation that you're doing to have? You're going to anticipate, your audience knows to expect certain moves and certain orders given upon the type of presentation that they've heard. So A, do you know what they expect in the term of arrangement? And B, Once you know, can you subvert those expectations to your benefit without annoying and isolating the audience? Style, make word sense choices to achieve audience impact. So A, are you avoiding the jargon that you need to avoid, but also are you using the technical terminology that you need to use? And can you differentiate between those two based upon the audience that you're talking to? Yes?
In terms of arrangement, I apologize, is it supposed to be logical or is it supposed to be what they're used to?
So there are, those are largely in harmony with one another. So logically, you want to be able to explain to the audience in the structure that they're familiar with. But we will talk a little bit about a reasoning structure in which you would not want to copy that exact reasoning structure. So you want to be able to make logical arguments. You want to be able to have your evidence and your claims and your warrants. But you also want to be able to arrange those in a way that sort of motivates the audience. So what's the fundamental form of reasoning, logically speaking? What's our base unit of information? Ideally, maybe hyper ideally. We get to this in a minute. So that. Do you start your presentation just outlining dozens of facts? No. Why not? Yeah, it's hard to remember. Absolutely. It's also boring. It's hard to remember and it's really boring. So, there are limits to, when we say logical, we don't necessarily mean a rational order so much as a reasoned way of going about sequencing that arrangement. So it doesn't necessarily mean outlining all of your facts first. It is logical to arrange in a form of moves that your audience recognizes. So by logical, what I really mean is that you're applying reasoning to the structure of your talk in this case. It's a great question. Yes?
You have a hand on the screen.
Oh, thank you. Please, Fernando.
Oh, thank you. I'm just reflecting what we just said, and I was going to comment. I was educated in South America and Argentina, and I worked both in Argentina for a long time and lately in the US. And something that I always struggle with is this expectation of the arrangement. Mm-hmm. And it has to do with what you're mentioning about the facts. I kind of find out that here, or in the States, it's more common to expect kind of an executive summary, so tell me what you're going to tell me, and then give me the facts, and then give me the conclusion. And I find out that I know that there are South American people here, so probably keep me honest, but I kind of think that different cultures think different or expect different about this.
Yes.
And saying those facts are boring, but as an Argentina, we prefer to kind of like, give me the facts, let me think what you're saying, let me make up my own conclusion, and then we can discuss the conclusion. So I don't like to have the executive summary first, I'd rather have the facts first. So I think that is somewhat depending on the way we think, and we not all think the same way.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. So first off, 100% correct. There's a lot of cultural variance when it comes to both the genre expectations and rhetorical expectations. And that variance is more than just the shape of the argument. It's where the argument is intended to take place. It's the delivery, the speed at which you come to introducing that information. So there are a lot of factors that you have to get to know, including getting to know your audience, getting to know samples of what this looks like in the space that your audience is used to hearing about it. So there's no shortcut to familiarizing yourself, reading and listening to the types of arguments that whoever it is that you're pitching to or talking to is familiar with. The goal here is not to provide you a template. The goal here is to provide you tools in order to be able to begin interrogating what that situation looks like. That sort of gets back to that chaotic element. What does the good argument look like in this context with this audience? So it's an excellent point. So the arrangement very much is also dependent upon cultural factors. As are some of the elements of style, when it comes to delivery, you want to be able to present. So, like I said, a lot of the wording here is very specific to Cicero, but present using grace, dignity, gestures, modulation of voice. I will tell you, 20 years of teaching, you can get a lot, you can go really far by sacrificing a little bit of dignity. sometimes the engagement is really worth sacrificing a bit of dignity. But you do want to keep all of these elements in mind, and it does vary a bit from audience to audience. All right, so let's talk a little bit about invention frameworks. So we've had a bit of discussion here, but let's think about this. Where does one find the arguments? Where do you go about, where does one find the types of arguments that you want to use with an audience? So if you're thinking about coming up with a persuasive pitch, you want to make an argument to an audience. What do you pull from? Actually, well, I do want to take some answers, but let's give just a couple minutes for people to think down, maybe write down some responses. Just give it a little bit of breathing room here. We'll slow it down. Now we can spread out. Ideas. Where do you find the argument that you're making? Yeah.
So I think a good way to do it is to start at what you're trying to convince someone of, and then break it down into the elements of what would I need to know or think in order to be convinced of that argument. So basically breaking it down kind of Minto pyramid style into those subordinate arguments.
Okay, so what are sort of the core objectives that I want to convince them of? What's the outcome? What's the kind of maybe even the policy decision that I want them to make? And then how do I go about getting them there?
Right, and it's more like, what would I need to think in order to believe basically that original premise?
Yeah, so what are the steps to get me to them accepting this policy outcome? Good. Yeah.
Can you find the arguments by understanding the other opposing views a little bit more?
Yeah.
That kind of generates how you can argue with them?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you assume that there are at least two sides to anything, sort of understanding what the establishing principles are of the other side are. So if there are multiple solutions, understanding why all the solutions are appealing as well as why the no-go might be appealing as well. Absolutely. Yeah.
It's helpful if the arguments imagine like the listener's values.
Okay.
You know, touch on the values and they're being very persuasive.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So being able to align those policy decisions with whatever the values of the listeners are, that audience, company values, organization values, but the individual values within those decision makers. Absolutely. Yeah.
For me, a lot of it comes down to where's your depth of experience, because you build credibility that way.
Yeah, so we're getting back to that ethos a little bit. What's your personal credibility and where does that come from? Absolutely. Yes.
You find some arguments in the assumptions within either the problem you're trying to solve, the industry, or your audience. What are some of the assumptions that you have? I think from there you can find your arguments.
Yeah, absolutely. So within that industry, within that community, what are some of their core beliefs? What are some of their maxims that they follow? What are some of the underlying assumptions that they buy into? So that you can, A, either use those as support, or B, you know that you might need to challenge some of those in some cases. Yeah?
So I also think about like what's some of the arguments that happened in the past. So just to look at the historical data and see what was the response from specific stakeholders or upper management.
Sure, absolutely. Look at some of the decisions that have previously been made and possibly understand either, you know, what chain didn't result in something going forward and what did. Absolutely. What logic has worked? One more, yeah.
What came down to me immediately was like controversy or conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And just starting from there.
Okay, so just starting with what the conflict is. And there's a lot of ways to break down controversy, but what is that open question? And being able to define what the controversy is actually very powerful. But being able to really get what the underlying open question is that exists. Because a lot of the times people aren't aware or actually have a misunderstanding about where that open question is within a controversy. So there's some non-technical, and we mean non-rhetorical technical, so data, testimony, laws, and maxims. Being able to break this down, so you know the underlying data supporting something, testimony, so what has happened in the past, what are some of the underlying witnesses to previous arguments, what are some of the laws and guidelines that underpin the arguments, and maxims. What are some of the beliefs within this organization, this industry, that you're going to encounter as part of this process? Also, big one is reasoning. We're going to get to some basic forms of reasoning, but how do you get to that policy outcome? How do you engage with the controversy? And particular forms of appeals, like our appeal to our personal credibility, our appeal to logic and emotion. And logic and emotion. I want to really emphasize that logic element. And, you know, our personal credibility, where our credibility comes from, is a little bit more than just credentials, but also, you know, building all of those elements together. And stasis ties into all of these. And most of you are not going to recognize this term, but we're going to dig into it here. All right, so stasis is a way of reasoning. It's a way of being able to identify where the controversy actually lies, and it's a way to be able to trace that policy outcome backwards. So if I was to ask, who stole my car? How would we go about resolving that controversy? Yeah. Eugene.
If there's any motive or evidence left behind.
Okay.
In your life.
Sure. So factually, is there any evidence available? And then from a motive, from a causative standpoint, is there anyone who has a reason to do so? Yes.
I'll then report the incident to the authorities to see if they have any clues on who stole your car, they have any reports or footage.
Sure, I mean, yeah, the obvious answer there is just to hand it off to someone else who's a lot more capable and has resources to handle the situation. Absolutely, yeah.
I'll first check the validity of the argument, like whether the person is right or wrong.
Yeah, is the car actually stolen? Maybe this is a definitional issue. If my kids took my car and I just don't know about it, it's not technically stolen. I mean, okay, most people wouldn't define that as technically stolen. So there is an open question possibly there of even, is there a stolen car? Definitionally, are we even talking about the same thing? So, one of the ancient concepts that Aristotle took from someone else that largely gets assigned to Aristotle is this idea of stasis. Stasis grows out of opposing forces of accusation and denial, controversy. Movement is brought to a stand that can be resolved through persuasion. So stasis, I mean, literally means standing in the same place. The idea is, how do you and your audience reach the same standing? How do you come to share a space of understanding? How do you close the open questions necessary in order to reach the outcome that you want to reach? And do you know the right questions to be able to reach that outcome? Classically, stasis has, four areas. The 20th century added a fifth, and it's very useful for our purposes, so we're going to keep the fifth. So, fact, definition, causation, value, and policy. What are the underlying facts? What are the core definitions? Do we agree on what those core definitions are? And very often we do not. Causation, how did this happen? What caused it? Value, how important is this? Is this a good thing or a bad thing at the most fundamental level? And frequently there's disagreement on that. And then after it, how bad or how good is it? And then policy, what do we do about it? And this is the type of chain that I was talking about before with when Thomas was talking about coming to an outcome. The basic reasoning chain of an outcome is, what are the facts? What are the core definitions? What are the causative elements at play? How important is this issue, or why does this issue need to be seen as important, whether it is good or bad, and then what do we do about it? And this was used as an invention exercise in classical times. Can you answer all of these questions in order to form your argument? Arrangement-wise, this is not how you would actually want to arrange your argument. You wouldn't want to put it in this order, but logically, you need to know the answer to these questions, and you need to be able to know these answers relatively in the sequence. So lower stasis need to be closed before we can reach agreement in higher stasis. So this is Senator Blackburn. Can you define what a woman is? At which point, future Supreme Court Justice Jackson says, I'm not a biologist, I'm a judge. So, can you answer this question? Well, it's not my field of expertise. Anybody familiar with the Hellmeyer's Catechism? Really popular in proposal workshops. So popular in proposal workshops. No one's seen the Hellmeyer Catechism? How many people are working on the Aero-Astro projects in here, or Aero projects? All right, okay. So, Hellmeyer is a engineer, project lead, DARPA lead. So, DARPA has a mural of these catechisms up on the wall. What are you trying to do? Articulate your objectives, using absolutely no jargon. How is it done today? And what are the limits of current practice? What is new in your approach, and why do you think it will be useful? Who cares? If you are successful, what difference will it make? What are the risks? How much will it cost? How long will it take? And what are the midterm and final exams to check for success? These questions remind you of anything? Yeah, it was a little bit of a push survey initially. What do they remind you of?
I mean, like, these are excellent questions to, like, define your objective and come up with a good proposal. So I'm just admiring all these questions.
Okay, yeah, they're very good. It's a very good set of questions. So this is a modern form of stasis. Now, Hellmeyer almost certainly didn't know about stasis and wasn't reading Aristotle when he put these together. What he did know is he knew fundamentally in the pitches that he had heard what he was looking for in terms of proposals and highlights, and how his engineers were not speaking on terms that he was going to be able to make core decisions on. But this is an excellent example of what modern Stacey's might look like. You know, what are you trying to do? Define for me what this solution is. Who cares? Why does this matter? What is the value proposition that you're putting forward? I can't say yes to this until I understand what the value is going to be from this. Can you prove, working backwards, causatively, that this value is actually going to come forth from the solution that you're promoting? Do I agree with your definition of the problem and the solution and the current state of the field that you're working from? And do I understand the underlying facts as you relay them to me? Are they in the style of language that I understand, both speaking to your credibility and making it accessible? This is a really tough one on the jargon versus technical terms. And you'll find that balance is really something that you have to work with a lot, is making yourself sound credible and knowledgeable, but still being accessible enough to be understandable and relatable to the audience members who really matter. So why does this matter for your product? So at the end of the day, policy is what matters. But in order to get there, you really have to close everything that comes before it. You have to be able to convince them of the value. You have to be able to convince them of the causal relationship that will lead to that value proposition. And you have to have an understanding definition of the definition of what the problem is, what you're doing, and what the solutions are. And then you also want to be able to support those factually. And you can't get to that policy outcome without knowing what the right questions are in these other areas. And as was excellent, like just like what Bernardo brought up before, these questions vary. It's one of the reasons that I wanted to show you the Hellmeyer Catechism, because they vary by industry, they're going to vary by audience. So coming up with the right questions to ask in these areas matters a lot. And you know your area of expertise far more than I do, but you want to think through what are the right questions for your context. What are the right value questions for what you're doing? What are the right questions about the problem and the solution that you need to define, and how do you establish those causal relationships? But before you start putting anything together, you want to make sure that you're asking the right questions and that you know where that disagreement with your audience is going to arise from. So just from the evaluation of the final deliverables, does the recommendation follow from evidence-based motivation and problem framing followed by clear arguments? Does the recommendation deliver value to the most important stakeholders? These are direct connections. Is the value clear? Have you defined the problem and the solution clearly? And is it rationally built up? Are all of those questions answered in order to get to that point? All right, so we're gonna do a little bit quicker on this one. If you try to persuade someone, but you're not successful, have you still performed a rhetorical action? So if you attempt to persuade, but you don't persuade, it's an interesting sort of force into a binary situation. Yeah?
I would say yes, because there could be other circumstances that lead to the person not being persuaded, whether he or she is intransigent or any other factors. It doesn't mean that you didn't perform the rhetorical action.
Okay, yeah, it doesn't mean you didn't perform a rhetorical action just because there may have been extenuating circumstances. Absolutely, yep.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's kind of what's getting trouble, creating trouble in our current environment, that it's not necessarily, it doesn't have to be binary. Like, if we don't agree, that doesn't mean one of us is wrong. We can have differing opinions. As long as you share your point of view, that's really what matters. And you shouldn't get tied down with bringing everyone over to your side.
Yeah. Yes.
I was going to say, it could be possible that you were persuaded on their argument, so they see.
Yeah, so maybe persuasion did happen. Absolutely. It's a very good point, and it's really important to keep in mind. Yes?
Going back to your definition of rhetoric, it dealt with the spread of knowledge.
Yeah.
Or the transfer, not necessarily the actual persuasion.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that's a really good point, is even if the policy outcome isn't moved, if you've moved definition, or if you've made awareness of a causal issue, then that is also success. It's not necessarily the full success, but moving the issue forward, or you coming to a better understanding of the knowledge issues at play, is also success. So, it says, if you build a bridge and upon completion does not pass inspection because it is structurally unstable, so nobody, cars, bridges can use it, did you actually build a bridge? I mean, yeah. So there is a bridge, and there's future possibilities there. What do we think? Yeah.
Depends on the person's definition of a bridge.
It depends on the person's definition of a bridge.
Yeah.
Sure.
By definition, you said you built a bridge, so you built a bridge.
Yeah. So you built a bridge. It's not that you haven't said it's a working bridge. No one made any causal claims that someone had to use it. Maybe it's an aesthetically pleasing bridge. there's definitely a humorous give and take here. Obviously, you want a successful argument. You want the outcome that you want. And it is hard to fill success without that full outcome. But it's not quite as binary as the bridge example. There are movements of definition and causation that can be done without that full policy outcome having occurred. So, we're familiar with ethos, pathos, and logos. Kairos should kind of right be here in the center. So, Aristotle says, ethos persuades in its most important cases where the facts or arguments are in doubt. Do you agree? Is credibility most important when there's factual doubt? It's okay to argue with Aristotle. People have been doing it for 2,000 years. You are not going to be the first.
Yes.
Yeah.
Assuming there's not an easy way to get more facts, then yes.
Okay, yeah. Jameson, you had your hand up?
I think the answer is also yes. I'm also not sure of a situation in which having more expertise means that people would be less inclined to listen to you. So I feel like it's sort of an interesting question to ask if having more expertise is somehow bad.
Spend more time online. I don't recommend spending more time online. But there are situations in which more expertise can be an issue. I would say for our practical purposes, that's a curse of knowledge issue. If more expertise causes you to talk in a way that is inaccessible, then perhaps there can be stylistic issues that happen. But I think that, you know, we've got to be realistic, and the level of institutional distrust that we currently live with has to be factored in to the context of the arguments that we're making. Yes?
I was just thinking to this, you know, recent phenomenon, I think it's called, like, death of the expert, basically, mm-hmm. where we've created maybe an unnecessary or, you know, unreasonable doubt in experts / you know, a raising of our own personal expertise based on maybe shallow knowledge. So doesn't that necessarily say that wouldn't that say that having more information or being more expert doesn't necessarily move the needle in those contexts?
It means that for various audiences, what counts as ethos shifts. Absolutely. So expertise may not be what an audience finds particularly compelling. This isn't new either. If you go to a small town board, are you going to have more ethos within that community as an outside expert or as a member of the community in testifying before the local town? Probably the local community. So this isn't new, and joke about online conversations. All right, it's half joke. Doesn't change the fact that this is something that all audiences have some sort of mixed framing with, and what counts as expertise can vary. Professionalized expertise is not the only form of expertise that your audience is going to recognize. Yes.
What if we look at it the other way, where the experts may feel that the audiences may not have sufficient knowledge to come to an informed decision? Like, how would you address this? I mean, is this even allowed? Like, do you think like the expert should ever have this kind of like framing in their head that, hey, like the audiences may not necessarily know what I'm gonna be talking about? Or should they like genuinely be and try and convince them with their knowledge?
Yeah, so that is a big ethical question that we are not going to answer within the time frame of this class. But it's complicated. Certainly, experts get together and make decisions on policy fronts. Some of them are put to the public, and some are not. It's a big ethical question, because the more you do away from the public, also that can also seed that distrust of the public not understanding what's going on, and a lack of public understanding leads to some of this credibility distrust. But it's a big issue. All right. So, who are you in the audience? So, situated, writers can enjoy a good reputation in the community, or invention, writers can invent a character suitable to the occasion. So, are you known to the audience? Are you that local town member who is well known to the community and respected for being a member? Or are you bringing your outside expertise and it's something that you have to communicate to the audience? There's a lot of ways to build ethos there. With invented ethos, you want the authority of your text or speech sort of generates itself, you know, through your actions. This is where that, like I said, that those issues of technical jargon, technical definitions sort of matter. You can have the virtues, you can perform the values of the community. Do you know what this organization, this business cares about? Can you communicate to them that you care about their maxims and their beliefs? Practically demonstrating, you know, the wisdom. Do you know what practical experience in this area looks like? Have you worked in this type of industry before? Do you know what it looks like down in the factory? And sort of goodwill and identification that you actually care. Can you convince them that you care about what's going on? Some elements of ethos building or virtue. You can brag or have someone brag for you, or you can brag on yourself. I wouldn't recommend that tactic in the vast majority of cases. Reveal a tactical flaw, a defect that shows dedication to the audience's values, or you can even switch sides. Make an inevitable decision against you look like a willing sacrifice on your part. So maybe we do decide that we've been persuaded to come to the other side, and really, that was our goal and lesson all along. For practical wisdom, you want to show off your experience so that you can bend the rules and devise innovative solutions so you know the way things work well enough to be able to innovate and move forward. Yes, Anna?
Can you go back to that?
Yes, absolutely.
Can you explain the second point again?
Yeah, so reveal a tactical flaw, defect that shows dedication to the audience's values. So, If you can expose something that they're doing wrong or that there is an issue at play that is contrary to their values. So if your proposal is fixing a value that they care about in a process or a system that they're using. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I know, but how do you do that without like being insulted?
that is a much more difficult tactical question. And I tell you what, you come to rehearsals, we'll work on it. All right, and then of course, building goodwill. You want to show disinterested goodwill, the appearance of having only the best interest of your audience at heart. Maybe the conclusion is reached reluctantly because of its overwhelming rightness. I'm not a huge fan of that one. Claiming the final solution will help the audience more than you, so sacrifice. You're doing this for them. So you're coming here out of the goodness of your heart in order to be able to assist them in solving these issues. Or you're coming this out of whatever fill in the virtue the company cares about in order to help them resolve these issues. Being able to just establish that audience with the speaker, knowing who they are, you want to think about the ways that an audience is multi-segmented and how it is that you're going to be able to work with that audience. So you do want to be able to identify who matters possibly more than others within any audience, and you want to be able to make yourself more persuasive, more likely to reach the decision makers. So if you can find out who the decision makers are, any good proposal writer has ever worked on, you want to find out who's making the decisions, why questions were written a certain way, because you want to be influencing the people who are eventually going to be making that actual decision. And you can sort of separate audience segments that you think, and this is, you've got to be careful here, because if you make the wrong decision, then you can really find yourself in a bad place. But you can cut away the segments of the audience that you don't think are going to be responsible for making that final decision, and just appeal to those who are. But you really have to be careful in making that choice, because if you cut out the wrong, if you're wrong, then it can backfire pretty dramatically. All right, so I'm going to wrap up here, and I just want to say that we look forward. I look forward to working with you. Nora is going to take over for the second hour in order to be able to talk with you, and we really look forward to working with you and sort of putting some of these rhetorical elements, you know, into play. Thank you very much.
Thank you. What we'll ask you to do is share with us a summary argument. So not a generic outline of the presentation, maybe set of content categories. Here we'll talk a little bit about the background of are the problem that we're addressing. This is where we'll talk about the solution, that sort of thing. But what we're looking for is an actual narrative abstract of the presentation. So a summary of the argument that you're going to make. So that would be one of the first things that we'll look at. And the focus of the second session is practice. So ideally, by the second meeting, which can be a 1 hour meeting, you'll have the presentation pretty much ready, and you're ready for a dress rehearsal. And so these meetings will happen on Zoom so that everyone can participate. And what we'll do is just devote the first 10 minutes of the meeting to a dress rehearsal of the presentation, and then we'll workshop and work through any gaps in the argument or any areas that need to be clarified. So we'll be, in a sense, your test audience, your first audience. So ideally, by then, you'll have, by the second meeting, you'll have the draft presentation ready. If you are not ready with that draft presentation, that's fine too. You can send us your slides and talk us through a for instance of what the presentation might look like. We will share with you details on how to sign up for these meetings. We recommend that you schedule the first meeting before the end of April. So the sooner the better. And that the second meeting will probably take place somewhere early in May, anytime before the official presentation meeting. So for the first meeting, we wanted to ask you to include in the materials that you share with us ahead of time a little bit of answers to a number of preliminary questions that help you contextualize the presentation or the recommendations that you're going to make. So the first question we'd like you to think about is, what specifically was the ask of your partner mentor? So what did they present to you as an area for research? And then also we'll ask you to do a little bit of background research on your partner mentor. So this could be anything that they shared with you in your weekly meetings, but it can also be background information you do on the company or business that you are partnering with. So for instance, what I typically do is you go to the website, you look at the mission statement, and you pinpoint and maybe extract from that mission statement a set of core values that they share, that's sort of part of their company identity. And these core values will be valuable, we call it hot button terms, that you can refer back to in the course of your presentation. So when you're thinking about stakeholder values, those would be typical terms that you'd like to echo several times in the course of the presentation as something that your recommendation gives. In addition to a little bit of background on what matters to your partner, think a little bit about how you could make a case for the urgency of the problem that you're addressing. So in addition to defining the motivating problem for your project, how can you make that problem seem urgent? So in the projects in SDM, I know that there's a variety of motivating situations. So in some cases, you're working on an urgent problem that you all agree on, or that most people would agree on being a problem that requires a solution. But in some cases, some of you are also working on novel opportunities. So situations that that most people don't recognize as a problem, or a problem that we didn't even know we had. So in that case, there's a slightly different approach in how you pitch your introduction. So in that case, what you need to convince your more general audience of is that this is a valuable opportunity, that something stands to gain from addressing it. Some of the projects are also more in the category of feasibility studies. So you are asked to investigate whether something would be feasible, profitable, worth pursuing in the first place. So in that case, at the end of your presentation, you're also sort of addressing a yes or no question, or a question of degree of feasibility. So all of these preliminary questions set you up to, at the end of your presentation, answering the right kind of question and creating an alignment between how you define the problem and your articulation of the solution. Having that alignment will create a sense of, will help you ahead in that task of persuading, right? If there's a disconnection between, if you're presenting a problem that's way too large for your solution to solve, there's going to be a disconnection in the credibility of how you present it to your case. Finally, and this is something that we'll go over in more detail in a minute, is we'd like you to include this, either you can think of it as a summary argument, so something concrete, specific to your presentation or to your project, or you can also think of it as a narrative abstract. So what is the abstract? What are the core claims that you're going to make in the presentation? So this, think of these not as a set of bullet points, but as a set of full sentences, assertions, claims. Claims that you are going to make and that you are going to illustrate and back with evidence in the course of the presentation. So this is, it's going to look a little bit like the abstract of a written technical or journal paper. So it's the high level argument that the paper makes, in this case that the presentation makes. So that's kind of the baseline that we'd like to work from in the first session. What we'll then do in the first session is to look for areas where you'll require reasoning. And in addition, we'll look at what kind of reasoning would be appropriate for which aspect of the argument. We'll also share on the campus a set of resources where we break down the core structure, the underlying structure of different types of claims. So value claims, for instance, have a different organizational structure than definitional claims. So we have a set of handouts that break down that structure and kind of itemize the moves that you make in each of these types of arguments. Okay. So then in the second meeting, as I mentioned, we will actually look at how you integrate claim and evidence and how you present the argument as a verbal argument. So presentations, first and foremost, are an engagement with an audience in here and now. And so presenter needs to maintain center stage. And so we'll talk a little bit about strategies to arrive at that. So I wanted to bring up a problem. Let's start from a problem with some presentation. So what can you think of as possible causes for presentations that are unclear, that are hard to follow? What are some of the, so think of the typical academic presentation. What are some of the reasons that presentations either fail to persuade, fall flat, or are hard to follow for an audience?
The point of the presentation isn't made abundantly clear.
Okay. Yeah.
There isn't a clear narrative, or it gets way too detailed for the level of thinking that, that the audience has.
Yep, so narrative arc is important, point needs to be made, and we talked in the first hour, there was the question of where is that point made, at the beginning, high level summary, or at the end, and so that's something that, yeah, go ahead.
I was listening to an interview by Jeff Bezos, and he was saying that PowerPoint presentation is like a marketing or sales tool, where like, you know, the presenter has a lot of power and the audience does not have enough information.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's why he usually prefers the mode of using a memo where, like, you know, which requires a lot of effort from the presenter to put in all the information. That way the audience has more information and they're able to resolve all the questions that come.
Yeah.
I think that relates to the point that as we made in the previous session about the balance between jargon and technical.
Mm-hmm.
In the presentation.
Yeah, overly technical can be hard for a general audience. Okay, so one of the reasons why presentations are hard to follow, so we're not clear what the main point is, you can look at that problem at the level of the individual slide. So one of the problems with a lot of slide presentations is that the slide is used inappropriately as the subtitling of what the speaker is already doing. Or, so pretty much the same information is presented in the slide, the same information the speaker is delivering, but in a different order or as a set of sentence fragments. Bullet points typically are incomplete sentences. So it's information that's not fully processed. And so what you're asking an audience to do is to read and listen at the same time and to compose meaning from a list of points that hasn't fully been processed. So I want to look at, we're going to look at a very simple example, but it captures very well some core missed opportunities in how the slide is designed. So the idea of PowerPoint as being, you know, it can be your ally and it can be sort of an obstacle in presentations. And there's been a lot of research into, you know, in a way how it has degraded information recall in audiences. And so one of the possible causes for this degradation is our over-reliance on how we are prompted to enter information in slideware, so that we are prompted to work with topic-based titles. So titles that tell you the category of information that we're going to talk about. So a title that says introduction tells you I'm going to give you introductory matter, but it doesn't tell you exactly what the main point is that you need to know to be able to enter into a discussion about this in your project. And it also prompts you to list information in these nested, sometimes hierarchical structures, sometimes not hierarchical at all, just a list of bullet points, and to enter sentence fragments, and primarily to enter text. So what the visual components, so Edward Tufte, for instance, is one of the people who studies this extensively. He's a professor at Yale in computer science, political sciences, statistician, has written extensively on data display. And so his argument is that the PowerPoint slide is the site for the visual evidence. So there's two things that a PowerPoint slide in a presentation segment can do. Number one, it can summarize the takeaway point of the segment. So instead of a topic title, introduction or background about coal mining, you make a claim that summarizes what you want, the one thing that you want your audience to remember from that segment. That would be the first thing, so that the title spot is often wasted for generic information. And then the second thing that a slide does really well, it's a visual medium, is to communicate symbolically rather than verbally. So the body of the slide becomes, you know, if you want to use it effectively, supporting evidence or illustration, and something that will illustrate that main waypoint at the top of the slide, or things like quantitative evidence, things that are hard to explain verbally. That's what you use the slide for. So that presenter and symbolic visual stream of information become complementary and not duplicates or overlaps or competing for the audience's attention. So that's one practical principle. And I want to stress that the recommendations we make, there's no one-size-fits-all template for technical presentations for any kind of good communication. So you need to sort of, as Michael also discussed, you need to think about what the expectations of your audience are, what their prior knowledge is, and also how much time you have to leave a slide up. All of these variants are going to determine what you want to put on the slide. But a good baseline takeaway would be to avoid textual content and to use the slide for what it does best, and it is communicate symbolically and visually. So the content categories that you will address in your presentations are what you can find in the SDM project guide. So this is primarily where you look for, what do I need to make claims about? So you're prompted with a whole set of questions. It's sometimes hard actually to answer all of them in 10 minutes. So there's a challenge for you to maximize your time. And one way to maximize your time is to let the slide do part of the work for you while you're talking, rather than using it for the same information. That's one way to make 10 minutes count for more, is to leverage that complementariness of visual. Okay, so this is, I'm going to show you an example and talk a little bit about this model of designing slides around assertion and evidence. It's an approach that was pioneered by Michael Alley at Penn State. He's a communications specialist, teaches engineering communication at Penn State. And so you may have heard, who has heard of the assertion evidence approach to slide design or used it before? Yeah. Okay, all right, so we'll go over the example. Like I said, it's a simple one, but I feel like it captures what we're talking about. So this approach is also evidence-based. Research, Alan Pamiu did research on, sort of pioneered this theory of how we lodge information, how we apply knowledge, lodge information in long-term memory. So one of the findings is that if we have a parallel stream of information, so if we have both a text slide and someone speaking at us at the same time, we are processing that information in the same area of the brain and there's conflict and short-circuiting. So, however, if we pair the verbal stream of information with a visual stream of information, what we found was that recall was greater than when we had only a verbal stream. So this is both for textual and spoken word, that combining the two, symbolic illustration and verbal, that you achieve greater information recall in your audience. Yeah.
I feel like sometimes we make presentations that we want to include the information because we want to give it to someone offline, right? Like we don't want to give them just a picture or something. We want them to be able to open the presentation and understand it without us speaking. So how do you balance that?
Excellent point. That's why you need the assertion title. Yeah? So the images or the data that you present in the body of the slide is the evidence. The title interprets the evidence. Tells the audience what, according to you, the evidence means. It's much more, it is going to give that offline reader of your slide deck way more information about your project than if you have a topic title. So let's say you show a chart with some results and you put at the top of the slide, results. We don't know what they mean to you. But if you add a descriptive observation at the top of your slide, now you're telling us, here's a claim and here's the evidence that supports the claim. So I think the usefulness of your slide deck offline increases, you know, if you add those descriptive observations or if the top of the slide is one sentence from, let's say, an abstract of a technical paper. That's the idea. Yeah. Go ahead, yes.
Sorry, I don't have my name tag, Lauren. Something that I've done before is I've had slides that kind of go out in a pre-read that have maybe more text on them, or they're more for like reading in advance or reading after, but they aren't actually the slides that I present. So I will always have the slides that I present, but then I might also have some slides that don't get presented.
Yes, backup slides. Yeah. And also in this particular scenario, there is your executive memo, which is textual document primarily, possibly with some images, but so you have different reporting on, or different documents that report on your project. So this is not going to be the most complete and detailed version of what you did in SDM together, and so the presentation serves one specific function of sharing your research and findings with primarily, so your audience is your instructors, your SDM peers in the class, and then also partner sponsors or partner mentors. Yeah. So yes, there's a balancing act. And every year in the rehearsal sessions, the question comes up. So we time the presentation when you do rehearsals. The presentation is too long. What do I cut? I can't cut this. It is crucial, essential to you. So I guess there is a judgment call that you have to make. And also, you can always keep that information on a backup slide and bring it up if it becomes pertinent in Q&A. Yeah.
Just another way to think about the assertion I've heard from management consultants, which everyone knows are the true experts at slide decks. They described it as the slide, don't think of it as a title, think of it as a headline. So like a newspaper headline has a certain amount of information, the key point of the article ideally is in. So I think you've got
slide as a headline rather than a title.
Yeah, a headline, or and Michael Allen calls it a message. He says you have a message, you can think of it as a claim or an assertion, and that requires, obviously, it requires some kind of evidence, and it's going to be inside the slide. So the research that this is based on is called the dual coding theory. It's applied in education. So if you want children to learn faster, retain more information from your lessons, you're going to combine an explanation with an illustration, and that creates a more memorable picture in long-term memory. All right, so our first recommendation, we want to recommend that you leverage the power of dual coding and that you design your slides, at least, or some of your slides, using this principle. So designing the slides not around topics, but around claims that you make about how you perceive the motivating problem, why you believe a particular method is appropriate, and why a recommendation delivers value. So the three principles of Michael Allen's assertion evidence approach are to build your slides around these messages, not topics, to support them with visual evidence. And finally, his recommendation is to practice so that you know pretty much you will have memorized the narrative abstract of your talk, but not necessarily the whole script. So that you are free in your, within one segment, you know what the takeaway point is, and it is at the top of the slide. And the rest of the segment, typically he recommends, is 7 to 10 sentences of narration and explanation, where you explain the causal relationship between your evidence and your main claim. And I want to look at a practical example of how that's done, whether or not you read the assertion title at the beginning of the segment or at the end or not at all. Some people don't do it at all. So here's how typically we may start creating a slide in PowerPoint. So we're thinking about, I need a slide about where I'm going to talk about my results, the effects of the use of green room. So this was a study to find ways of mitigating the heat island problem in urban areas. So let's see how green roofs can address this problem. And I need a slide about the effects of green roofs. Then I'm going to add a set of bullet points. Here are some of the topics that I'm going to address in this segment. I'm going to tell my audience that the study was conducted in Chicago. I'm going to mention that I performed a comparison of a green roof versus a non-green, a traditional roof. And I'm going to say that I took infrared camera images to prove and quantify that green roofs lower the temperature in the building. And then I'm going to tell you that the temperature of green roofs is in fact lower, not just in the building, but also around the building. And finally, I'm going to quantify that in terms of how much money that can save you on your heating bills. So these are all the points that I'll address. They're sort of scrambled in a bullet point list. And then I'm going to add an image just to make it more vivid. Now, so going back to the assertion evidence approach, one of the problems or things that we want you to think about is the value of this. So we recommend, and Michael Alley recommends, to avoid these topic-based titles and instead to think about a full sentence. So what could be the full sentence title of this slide? Yep.
Installing green roofs on buildings significantly lowers the temperature inside.
Yeah, it's right there in the bullet point list. Yeah? So the takeaway point of the slide is actually one of my talking points. I was just going to mention that as my third point, but why not put it at the top of the slide to give it prominence? So this here, temp of green roofs is significantly lower, is going to be moved here. That's going to be my central claim. So the other thing here, so we recommend that you avoid these bullet lists when possible and that you use supporting evidence in the body of the slide. So what are some of the things that I could, from the bullet point list, that I could visualize instead of give you textually in this slide? Yes?
Yeah, Crosspoint, Chicago, maybe you can put the map.
The map, yeah. So that's something that I could render visual. Other things. Yep.
That you do a comparison, yes, before and after.
Yeah. Compare person is one of, so visual communication is extremely good at, much better than textual, at showing relationships, comparing things, because you're showing them side by side. It's not, communicates at a glance rather than, you know, forcing the audience to read a sentence. So comparison, what else can I render visually?
You can show the savings in the form of a graph or a table.
Yeah. So I could quantify the savings, financial and in terms of temperature. So those are two metrics I can show. There's something else, yeah?
You could include a schematic or visual that illustrates infrared camera
yes.
in the measurement.
Yeah, the whole point of infrared imaging is that it's going to show heat map, so you're going to show that image rather than say that you took that image, right? So notice that the bullet point list is describing what I did as a research. The focus is on my actions as a research and not on my findings. So that it's one of the core underlying problems, I think, with PowerPoint presentations is that they prompt you to design your presentation in a presenter-oriented way, listing things that you did, listing things that you find, and not focusing on the research, the needs of the audience. So taking yourself out of that equation, but taking that center stage as the messenger of this information, and so restoring, that creating a different type of relationship between presenter and audience and evidence. Okay, so those are all things we can illustrate. So I want to show you a redesign of this slide. So I now moved that third bullet point to the top. So for instance, it can be phrased differently, that results show that green roofs are extremely effective in diminishing the urban heat island effect. And now I'm going to show you the comparison. So I'll show you the two buildings side by side, the one with the grass, the one without. And I'll also show you the infrared image that I took that shows concentration of heat, and there's a metric measure on the side. So all of the information from the bullets is still there, and there's a caption here. So it could be in a map. In this case, it's a caption. All of the information from the previous slide is there, and it probably is easier to read this slide than the previous slide, because the visual information can be taken in at a glance. Textual information needs to be processed. This is one piece of information that's now gone, could be added, and that is the cost savings. Now, that's no longer there. So now I want to show you how the speaker integrated the slide, so the segment, the whole segment, how she presented this segment of her presentation. I hope this video works.
Why should we choose green roofs over any other method? Well, as we already discovered, urban heat islands make cities have higher temperatures than the surrounding rural areas. And these images show a really great representation of that. So take a look at the picture on your left. That's showing Chicago City Hall with the green roof, and then next to it is a building with a conventional rooftop. Now take a look at the picture on your right. This is showing the drastic difference between the temperatures and the surface temperatures of these two surfaces. We can see the conventional rooftop is reaching temperatures of 150 degrees Fahrenheit, whereas the green roof is only reaching temperatures of about 70 to 80 degrees. So this is a big difference. And the green roof not only has a cooler surface temperature, but it also has cooler air around it as well as inside the building. Another benefit to green roofs is actually the cost. And although green roofs have a higher upfront cost, that cost is then offset by the lower energy bills in the future. Studies have shown that on average for a 21,000 square foot roof, you can save about $200,000 over the lifetime of that green roof.
Okay, so notice that she introduced the segment not by reading the main point, the takeaway from the segment, but with rhetorical questions. With a rhetorical question. Other things that you noticed about integration of slide in presentation. Yep?
She directed you 2 points on the slide.
Yeah, yes. So she gives verbal cues in the image. That's often missing. You put different graphics, several graphics on your slide, and how do you direct the audience's eyes? Some people point, but it's even easier to just keep facing your audience and to give them a verbal cue, image on the left, image on the right. Okay? Other things that stand out. Did she ever give you the headline, the main claim, main takeaway? As listed up top. No, she didn't, right? So And yet you got that point very clearly, maybe even without reading it. Maybe you didn't even read the headline because you were listening to her. But she conveyed the idea multiple times in different language. So she said a big difference, drastic decrease in temperature. So the message was delivered in multiple ways, and it was quantified. It was quantified in terms of how much the temperature was lowered. It was quantified in how much money you could save by installing a green roof. So the claim was repeated over and over throughout the segment without ever being read as stated at the top of the slide. This is one way you can organize your segments. And I think one of the advantages, it's not always going to be like this, but one of the advantages is that you have maximized time. So you have taken, let's say, 1 minute from your presentation, or you wanted to convey, let's say, 11 ideas, and you never repeated an idea. So the text, the slide was communicating part of your message, and you were giving different versions. Yeah, let's see
the point. That's the first one. You don't have the illustration, but you have a point you want to make. What would be the best strategy to?
Yes. When you don't have an illustration. Yes, sometimes some of the graphics that we use on presentations feel a little bit gratuitous. So it's time for Q&A, and put a question mark on our last slide. So that is, I think, the place where transitions come in. So this is where you don't necessarily need to, what you're going to build is bridges between the elements of your argument, and you don't need to visualize that. So this is for the howevers or the turns in your argument. Often you don't need that, and that's fine. And what you can do at that point actually is wait to put up your next slide. Transitions are especially effective when they set up the next piece of visual evidence. So yes, there will be moments when you just don't have anything to show, and I think it's better actually not to become too fanciful and put up thinking icons for your transitions. Sometimes when you're summarizing or you're introducing your Q&A, another thing that you can do is put up a visual summary of the presentation. So a set of small, summary images that capture the totality of your argument. So that's another thing.
Does it get monotonous to have a deck full of just images? Wouldn't it come to a point where you actually have to have text? I'm wondering.
So I would say yes, and valuable text. So remember about the cognitive load on the audience, right? So a lot of text won't be processed. So perhaps it was there, and it was comforting to us as presenters that it was there, but it's not going to be processed. And so it might as well not have been there at all, right? So you have to ask yourself what in the here and now of a live presentation will be processed, and it's going to be minimal. It's going to be one sentence and a couple of call-outs, I think, is especially useful. And the rest is you. The text is you. You're embodying the text. And the stronger your connection with your audience, the greater the likelihood that that information, or the gist of that information, will be retained. Does it become monotonous? It can, if there is no attention to design at all in the images that you select. I think it certainly can. You can also animate your slides and reveal them gradually, or have ways of highlighting areas on your slide as you're making your point. But think about TED Talks, sometimes entirely without images, and can be extremely engaging too. So I think, or presentations with minimal images. Can be, I think, extremely engaging. And I think some of that comes down to the power of your argument and your ability to engage and establish urgency for the problem that you're addressing. Yeah?
What would your recommendation be for people who are engaged in research where sometimes they have to explain their research methodology? So in that situation, I mean, are they still encouraged to focus only on the results? Or should it change based on the setting?
Yes, I definitely, and there are a variety of ways of illustrating methodology too, right? When you're thinking about computer systems, for instance, you can have system diagrams that illustrate prior approaches to solving the problem and how your solution and shows that your solution, for instance, is a hybrid of those prior solutions or something that we can model. So you can use diagramming for methodology. In this particular case, in SDM, what you're going to show about your methodology is your application of the core concepts of systems design, right? How you conducted your systems architecture, engineering, and project management, how you use the tools that you learned. And so for each of those, probably you have a data point to show, right? What you derive or what you found out by using those tools. So, and I would say that's it. Would you say that's part of your methodology in SDM, right?
Yes,
yeah.
I think so.
Yeah. One question you might have. Okay. So another example.
Sorry, can I ask a question?
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Yeah. Go ahead.
There was a point there made on her starting with the rhetorical question. I kind of missed that. Can you come back to that and say more about that? The rhetorical question that she's using for opening?
Oh, yeah. So she, instead of saying, we found, in my research, I found that green roofs significantly lower or address the problem of heat islands in urban settings. What she said is, so what could green roofs do? I believe it's something along those lines. So in what way could green roofs help mitigate this problem of urban heat islands? So what she's doing is she's kind of following the cognitive process that an audience might be going through who hasn't done the research yet and doesn't know the results. And so she's raising it as a question. So she probably defined earlier in the presentation a problem and is then using a rhetorical question to, in a way, simulate possibly the thinking process that the audience might be going through. It's the same technique as saying, now let's analyze this example. You are inviting, you're taking the perspective of your audience, you're taking, and you're inviting them into the thinking process of your presentation. So that's, I think, why rhetorical questions can be useful. I wouldn't do it in every transition because then it becomes monotonous, right? It's just one tool that you can use in a transition. Sometimes a transition will be a high-level summary of the main point. And actually giving high-level summaries of the main point becomes especially useful when you're running out of time. So let's say that you're realizing that your presentation, that you're going to be asked to end your presentation, then what you can do is lead with the main point and work your way back to it and make your segments a little shorter. That's something you can do on the spot, rely on the spot. One more example, and then we will be out of time, is for instance, if you're displaying data. So the reason why it's important not to give your data slides a topic title, but an assertion or a claim-based title, is because data can be interpreted in different ways. It can be interpreted to mean different things depending on how you look at it. So here's a chart from the New York Times, and the information that is charted is the number of female chief executives in the Fortune 500. That's the data on this particular issue. So the chart title labels the kind of data that's shown. That's that accompanies the data point. In your presentation, we recommend you interpret those data. What do they mean in the context of what you're interested in? So we could add this interpretation. Say that, well, on the basis of these data, fewer women are leading the biggest companies. Can you think of any other ways of interpreting this chart? Yeah?
There's an increasing number of women CEOs over the last 20 years.
Yes, so you're almost taking a different perspective, right? One is of decline, fewer, but we can see over the long term, there is an increase. So an example that's very similar to what you said, you can think of it as fewer women leading the biggest companies or female CEOs are trending up when you look at it, not just in the context of a single year, but over a set of years. And so if you don't do that act of interpretation, your audience might do it and might look at it in a positive or a negative light. And so, all the more reason for you to contextualize your data. And we are out of time. We will put these slides and the
document